For our audience of blind and print-impaired folks, the North Carolina Reading Service today brings you... It's the Indie Week from October 6th, 2021, read today by John Federson. And we're excited to return to our underwater studio for this podcast, since we were up in our dirigible tower just a few weeks ago. We're told that the most severe leaks have now been patched, and, of course, for safety, we're down only at a shallow depth today. And for this occasion, our musicians with our theme music are once again the Beluga Boys, and they're up from SeaWorld just for you today. And we'll hear from the Beluga Boys later in the broadcast. Okay, I've managed to put one of my socks in that little bubble you may have heard on the air. And we'll get on with our article. And the cover story is called Water Damages. 14 years ago, a hug might have saved Mike Partain's life. It was 2007, and Partain had been working as an insurance adjuster in Tallahassee, Florida, when he and his wife lived a short drive from the Gulf of Mexico. The hug was an innocuous one, but Partain's wife felt something out of the ordinary, a hard knot in her husband's chest. They thought it might be a cyst or an ingrown hair, but when 2 weeks passed and the lump hadn't gone away, the 39-year-old went in for a mammogram. Partain is an amateur astronomer. He spends nights peering up at the sky to help, as he says, keep things in perspective. That's why, when the radiologist pulled up the scan showing a mass of cancerous cells illuminating his chest, all he could think about was a globular cluster, that collection of millions of ancient stars he'd seen so often through a telescope. A biopsy confirmed the cancer, a tumor the size of a large grape lodged in Partain's right breast. Being diagnosed on the day of his wedding anniversary, no less, was the most afraid he had ever been. Even more the time he had been robbed at gunpoint, working at a restaurant in college. He couldn't sleep, and eventually called his doctor asking to have his surgery moved up. "I've never been more scared of anything in my life," he says. Well, the operation was a success, and a month later, Partain began chemotherapy. He had questions, namely, why had an otherwise healthy, still young man who didn't drink or smoke, with no family history of the disease or preconditions, end up with breast cancer, a diagnosis that occurs for men in less than 1% of all cases. Partain still vividly remembers his first day of chemo. It was a clear, hot Florida afternoon when he emerged from the clinic to a call from his father. The elder Partain was a Marine through and through, born on Parris Island in South Carolina and a veteran of the Vietnam War. Partain was not used to seeing his dad emotional, so when he picked up the phone and heard a shaky voice on the other end of the line, he knew something was wrong. Partain's father, "You need to go home now and turn on CNN. He rushed back and switched on the TV. On it, Bart Stupak, a representative from Michigan, was speaking before a congressional committee. Partain made it in time to catch the end of his introduction. Quote, "Whether individuals born between 1968 and 1985 to mothers who drank contaminated water while they were pregnant and living in Camp Lejeune are at increased risk of developing certain childhood cancers." It was a line Partain says he will never forget. He says, "I realized right then and there I was one of those kids. I knew what had happened to me." After nearly 15 years and countless hours spent researching, organizing, and traveling to Washington, Partain is among a cohort of thousands still fighting for recognition and compensation from the U.S. military over decades of negligent water contamination at Lejeune that caused myriad cancers and other significant negative health impacts in service members, families, and employees on the base. A new bill working its way through Congress aims to provide relief to some of those thousands affected by the toxic water Camp Lejeune Justice Act would allow anyone exposed to contamination on the base between 1953 and 1987 to sue the government for damages. Representative David Price, one of the bill's co-sponsors, says, "For decades, thousands of service members and families were exposed to contaminated tap water at Camp Lejeune, likely increasing their risk of developing cancers and adverse birth outcomes. The state of North Carolina, where this tragedy occurred for nearly 30 years, has made it clear they wish to allow those who have been suffering for too long to have their day in court. It's now the federal government's responsibility to right this wrong and provide the opportunity for these individuals to seek long overdue justice." Built in 1942 in Jacksonville, North Carolina, as a training facility for troops for World War II, Camp Lejeune, at more than 240 square miles, remains one of the largest military bases on the East Coast. Lejeune currently supports roughly 100,000 people, plus a mall and 80 firing ranges. In the early 1980s, the Marine Corps discovered elevated levels of volatile organic compounds, called VOCs, in the drinking water on Lejeune, including PCE, tetrachloroethylene, and TCE, trichloroethylene. Other contaminants included refined petroleum products, such as benzene, a known carcinogen, had tainted the drinking water far beyond levels deemed acceptable to both EPA and Center for Disease Control via the leaking of underground storage tanks, industrial area spills, and waste disposal sites. As much as 1.1 million gallons of fuel may have leaked from storage tanks on the base, according to a separate report. Further research has indicated that the contamination may have begun as far back as 1948. A 2017 CDC report concluded the contaminants, quote, increased cancer risk and increased potential of experiencing adverse non-cancer health effects for those who had been on the base and consumed or otherwise been exposed to the water. Considering Lejeune's size and the fact that the contamination lasted decades, the government has since disclosed that as many as 1 million military and civilian staff and their families may have been affected. Nearly 275,000 of them have signed up as part of the Marine Corps database intended for those who lived or worked at Lejeune during that period in question. Moreover, documents show that, despite being notified by a testing agency of this contamination as early as 1982, over the years the U.S. military has dragged its feet on addressing the issue and notifying those impacted. Partain's parents arrived at Lejeune in 1967. Having graduated from the Naval Academy a year earlier, Lejeune was Partain's father's first duty station. He was born on the base on January 30, 1968, not long before his father deployed to Vietnam. Partain says, "Luckily for me and my mom hated Camp Lejeune." They remained on base another 5 months after his birth before heading across the country to live with Partain's grandparents in California. But by then, Partain says, the damage had already been done. He says, "Every time my mother drank water from Camp Lejeune, went to the Burger King, got a soda, took a shower, cooked on the stove using the water, every time that happened, those dice rolled." He's consulted with many epidemiologists and health experts since his diagnosis, all of whom have helped crystallize his understanding that his cancer was caused by the water at Lejeune. Indeed, his younger sister, who was born in Maryland, has remained healthy. Partain's mother has also been spared any significant health complications. The first person Partain spoke with after switching off the television in 2007 was Jerry Ensminger. Ensminger, a former Marine who Partain calls a walking human encyclopedia of all things Lejeune, was the driving force behind the poisoned patriot's testimony with Representative Stupak. By the time of that hearing, Ensminger, who served as a Marine for nearly a quarter century, had been fighting for a seat at the table for years. He'd often get up at 3 a.m. so he could drive from his home in North Carolina to Washington, D.C., meet with lawmakers, and, quote, get the hell out of Capitol before the afternoon rush hour. In 2012, Ensminger helped pass the Janie Ensminger Act, named after his daughter, who was born at Lejeune and died of leukemia at the age of 9. The bill provided health care for people who lived or worked at that base between 1957 and 87. That win, however, has proved short-lived. According to one report, between 2011 and 2019, less than 25% of the more than 84,000 Lejeune-related claims by veterans and their families made to the VA were accepted by that agency. In 2019, the Navy said it would deny the more than 4,000 pending civil claims against it over the water contamination, citing a lack of legal standing on behalf of the claimants. The new Justice Act is more broad and perhaps more importantly includes a clause that would circumnavigate North Carolina's statute of repose, a much maligned state law that prevents affected parties from filing suit more than 10 years after the, quote, last act of the defendant. That limit means that for Partain, Ensminger, and thousands of others, that window for filing any sort of legal action for what happened at Lejeune closed long before they ever knew they were in danger. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court decision further cemented the state's statute of repose, finding that it takes precedence even over federal law. In response, the North Carolina General Assembly inserted a clause the following year, effectively exempting groundwater contamination for that 10-year limit. But for Partain, the change was too little too late, and he has resigned to pinning his hopes on the Justice Act. The bill has gained traction, attracting more than 60 co-sponsors in the House, while a similar bill has also made its way into the Senate. Partain and other proponents believe the best way to move forward is by attaching the bill to the National Defense Authorization Act, that's the military's budget, the same way the Janie Ensminger Act was eventually passed. So far, though, that strategy has fallen flat. Besa Pinchotti, executive director for the National Military Families Association, one of the groups helped pushing the bill, says, "We still have hope. This is the closest we've ever been on the Lejeune issue." And she says, "Jerry and all of these tens of thousands of victims of the contamination, they gave their all for their country. They sign up to protect us, to fight for us, and then we don't do the same for them? It's a gross injustice and something I can't believe is still happening." Matt Slavowski, a spokesperson for Representative Matt Cartwright, the Pennsylvania Democrat who co-sponsored the Justice Act, echoed Pinchotti's statements. The congressman, quote, "remains committed to working with the Judiciary Committee to find a path forward for this bill," Slavowski wrote in an email. Ensinger isn't holding his breath. He calls the Defense Department the 800-pound gorilla in the room on Capitol Hill, a behemoth of an agency that is equal parts powerful and blame-averse. That, coupled with precedent like the Ferris Doctrine, which effectively prevents military members from receiving damages from the government, makes fighting in situations like this feel like an impossible, unending slog. Part of the issue is proving causality. As a kid, Partain got sick frequently. When he put on dry, cleaned dress clothes to go to church on Sundays, he'd break out in a rash. He nearly failed to graduate high school because of how many sick days he was forced to take. Now, he says, he has neuropathy stemming from the chemotherapy. He has joint and tendon issues and says he skipped middle age and went straight to being an old man. But while he might not be able to prove without any shadow of a doubt in court that Lejeune and the DOD are to blame for the cancer and his health issues, he at least wants a chance to try. He says, "It's not guaranteed we would win. We could still lose. If my case was heard in court and was heard fairly, and they came back and said, 'Mike, the government made a mistake, but they are protected,' I could understand that. But to use a technicality on something that's just wrong, that doesn't sit with me." But the surgical precision with which that Justice Act was written means that folks like Partain might have a real chance at securing damages from the government, says Reich Longest, director of the Duke Environmental Law and Policy Clinic and a clinical professor at Duke University Law School. He says, "The good news for the plaintiffs is the language of the text, if it were passed, has a very specific set of procedures laid out, All they have to do is show they were harmed and that there was a relationship between Lejeune and harm. The evidentiary burden here would be very reasonable. Partain has a larger point he wants to drive home, though, one about the way the military treats its veterans, servicemen, and women. He saw it with his father, who was exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam, and with his fellow Lejeune survivors, many of whom have since passed away. He says, the government poisoned 1 million Marines and their families over a 38-year period, and they washed their hands and walked away from it on a technicality. What does that say about our country, values, and what we're about? This is about individuals who served their country, their family members who supported them, and what the government did through their own negligence, and how they've just walked away from it like nothing happened. That's wrong on every level. A 2011 documentary about that contamination called Semper Fi, Always Faithful, features Ensminger and Partain, along with a host of other veterans and their family members, some who have remained close over the years, bonded through shared trauma. But Partain is constantly reminded of those who did not make it. Names like Joseph Moser and Peter Devereaux. The other day, Partain sent me a photograph of an obituary from a newspaper in Florida of a woman born in Lejeune a few years before him who had died of cancer. This Sunday, Lejeune survivors plan to gather in Jacksonville and perform outreach and push for the passage of the Justice Act. Samantha Villa, a lead organizer for the event and administrator for the 17,000-member Camp Lejeune Toxic Water Survivors group on Facebook, lived on the base with her family from 1976 to 1988. Her father, a Marine for 24 years, died in 2020. Due to Lejeune-related chemical exposure, Villa says, and her mother passed a year later to multiple myeloma. Villa herself has suffered from multiple bouts of cancer. She says, I made a promise to my father that I will keep fighting for his brothers in arms. I want nothing more than the Camp Lejeune Justice Act to get approved so it can save the lives barely hanging on. In 1989, Lejeune was declared a Superfund site by the EPA, one of some 130 sites on military land across the country. But despite the ongoing cleanup effort, contamination troubles have continued. Last year, the agency found elevated levels of PFAS, called forever chemicals, in the groundwater in multiple areas on the base. For Partain, the whole situation is emblematic of the way powerful groups treat the environment and people. The Lejeune cohort just happens to be the canaries in the coal mine. Our modern industrial society, he says, has a lot of benefits, but there are always hidden costs, and those hidden costs come in the form of our health. Partain is now in remission, or no evidence of disease, NED. As the parlance goes, he jokes, Ned and I are good friends now. And because he is still able, he believes it his duty to continue fighting, faithful to the cause, to the very last. I'm every bit as indignant with the government as when I started, he says. There are a lot of people who aren't here right now, who don't have a voice. Because I survived, I had a responsibility to speak out. If I don't speak out, then who does? For that last article, I neglected to cite the author, Jade Wilson, writing for the Indie Week. Now from Tomasi McDonald in Durham, car trouble. What Donna Frederick says she endured at a South Durham auto dealership in late summer gives an altogether different meaning to this term, car trouble. Frederick, retired and living on a fixed income, is a former owner of the Playhouse Toy Store on 9th Street. She says the service department at Michael Jordan Nissan repaired the timing belt on her 2015 Nissan Versa, but the dealership's sales department tore her credit apart. Frederick says a salesman at the dealership on U.S. 15501 applied for a $24,000 auto loan with at least three different agencies without her permission. She says the process placed 5 hard inquiries on her credit history and lowered her credit score at a time when she's trying to work out a forbearance plan with her bank to save her home. According to consumer education platform Forms Advisor, a hard credit check or inquiry takes place when someone applies for a loan, credit card, or an increase in a line of credit. A hard inquiry can lower one's credit score. A salesman last week at Sir Walter Raleigh Chevrolet also told the Indy that a hard credit check can lower one's credit score. By comparison, soft inquiries have no impact. Forbes reports that if a lender checks a consumer's credit report, the inquiry won't show up and is only visible on consumer disclosures via a personal request. Frederick says the red flags that appeared on her account prevented her from cashing her monthly Social Security check at her bank. She's not even sure she can cash this month's government check at her bank. If what Frederick says happened really happened, it's not a good look for an auto dealership that prominently features the name and logo of a living legend who is arguably the greatest basketball player of all time. Last week, Dean Ives, general manager of that dealership, said Frederick's account of the events is, quote, not factual, and that as a respected dealer, the business does not engage in practices that are harmful to its customers. And he says, to be blunt, there would be no, absolutely no reason to attempt to secure financing on behalf of a consumer without their knowledge or consent. If for no other reason due to the extreme inventory crisis plaguing the auto industry, he said in an email. We simply do not have enough vehicles to meet the needs and desires of interested parties as it is. We in no way desired then or now to harm Ms. Frederick, nor was there any malicious activity with regard to interactions with her. Nanzeen Ahmed, press secretary for Attorney General Josh Stein, told Indy the dealership's action could potentially be a violation of the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act and encouraged Frederick to contact the DOJ, Department of Justice office, to file a complaint, and said in an email to Indy, and if she's concerned about identity theft and potential violations of North Carolina's identity theft statute, she should also consider contacting local law enforcement. Frederick says a credit history showing that an unemployed retiree on a fixed income tried to secure a $24,000 loan to buy a car may hurt her chances of keeping her home. Frederick has not paid her monthly mortgage since July of last year, when the Center of Disease Control and Prevention imposed a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, with so many people across the country thrown out of work due to the pandemic. With the moratoriums ending on September 30th, Frederick has been working with Wells Fargo Bank on a forbearance plan to save her home. Things seemed to be working out. Then on August 25th, she was sitting in the service department waiting area, looking at her phone when she was approached by a young salesman who told her she could receive an above-average price for her car if she was willing to sell it to the dealership, who would in turn sell her a 2020 Nissan Kicks. She says, he told me a lot of people are looking for used cars, and we can give you a great deal if you trade in. A widely reported semiconductor chip shortage has recently prompted automakers to cut their production of vehicles. As a consequence, the limited supply of new cars and trucks has led to an increased price for used cars. She says, I thought, I got a couple of hours, why not look? Why not indeed? The young salesman showed her a 2020 Nissan Kicks that the dealership had just taken off the showroom floor. She explained, he said the Kicks was an upgrade and that the dealership would buy her car and also pay off the loan amount left on the vehicle. Frederick told the salesman which bank was holding the loan on the car. He left to, quote, run some numbers, return, and said he could get her in the Kicks for a monthly payment of $500 a month. Frederick says, I told him no way. I told him I was retired and didn't have any money. I was just trying to get my car fixed. Undeterred, a second salesman assured Frederick they were pretty close before ducking away to again run some numbers. He returned and told Frederick she could get the car with a monthly payment of $470. I told him no again, Frederick said. I told him I can't pay that. I don't have a job. I'm in retirement. Frederick told the salesman he should talk with her niece. She's looking for a car, as he explained to him. Maybe she'll be interested. She got into her newly repaired car and went home. 2 days later, she received a letter from officials with Langley Federal Credit Union out of Newport News, Virginia, who thanked her for applying for an auto loan, but she was not approved for the $24,000. On September 1st, she received a second letter from officials with Town Bank in Virginia Beach, Virginia, who also informed her she had been denied the $24,000 she had applied for. A third Virginia lending institution, Northwest Federal Credit, sent a letter that informed Frederick her application from Michael Jordan Nissan had been instant denied. I thought, now wait a minute, she says. These are all car loan applications. I didn't apply for a loan. It was the first of the month. Her Social Security check had arrived in the mail, and she went to Wells Fargo to cash it. When I got to the bank, the teller said, I can't cash your check, and it won't let me deposit it. I said, why not? It's a government check. The teller told Frederick to come back tomorrow. I said, okay, no problem. I'll get the manager to check on my account. But when Frederick returned, the teller told her the account had been flagged. She eventually went to another bank and cashed her check. She then went online and obtained a 43-page copy of her credit report. And she says, there at the very bottom, it showed that someone had made 5 hard inquiries and 1 soft one on August 25. They were all from Nissan. Forbes advisor notes that a single hard inquiry can lower a credit score 5 points or less and stays on a credit report for 2 years, but only impacts the score for 1 year. Ives, the dealership's general manager, remains unconvinced that actions by his dealership had anything to do with the bank refusing to cash that check. He told the Indy, in my 30-plus years as an educated businessman, I know of no provisions for a bank to refuse to cash a check or withhold funds due to inquiries. To do so seems highly suspect and bordering on illegal, and perhaps is due to other circumstances. My advice to Miss Frederick is to discuss this subject with the bank manager. I have also attached documents from Experian and Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that outlines regulations that guide inquiries and credit. The documents contradict the Forbes advisor report and what appears to be conventional wisdom. The document from CFB.gov, quote, shopping for the best deal on an auto loan will generally have little to no impact on your credit score. It also states it's not legal advice or regulatory guidance. A question and answer from Experian notes, quote, most credit scoring system allow people to shop for the best rates on car loans without having a negative impact on credit scores. They do so by counting all inquiries for auto loans within a given time as a single inquiry. And as for submitting auto loan applications without someone's permission, Ives told the Indy he, quote, will respectfully disagree. And he says, she not only test drove or viewed multiple vehicles, she also willingly provided address, Social Security birth date, and income information. We certainly were not privy to that information prior to her providing it. And moreover, a person doesn't provide such information unless they are attempting to purchase a vehicle. Per the State Attorney General's press secretary statement regarding identity theft, it is illegal for a car dealership to run a hard pull of a customer's credit without their permission. Frederick called the dealership and talked with Justin Bowden, the company's consumer affairs manager, who promised to undo the errant inquiries. Frederick says Bowden texted a confirmation note from Experian to her on September 15, indicating the inquiries would be dropped from her credit report by October 15th. Bowden did not return calls and an email from the Indy last week, but Ives said his fellow manager went, quote, above and beyond, stepping outside the scope of responsibility in an effort to assist Miss Frederick with regard to these inquiries, even though they are legitimate. But Frederick is standing her ground. She says, I don't care if I test drove 50 cars. I didn't give them permission to apply for a $24,000 car loan. She called Nissan America and a legal firm she found online. She also filed complaints with the Department of Justice and the Better Business Bureau, and she contacted the lending agencies that denied the Nissan salesman that loan on her behalf. Ahmed, The Attorney General's press secretary told the Indy she's not aware of Frederick says about what happened to her being commonplace, but added, quote, it's always possible that such situations are underreported to our office. As for saving her home, Frederick says she spoke with someone from her bank's customer service division and said they are aware of what's going on. So Frederick remains hopeful, but still furious. She says, I wish I could get in touch with Michael Jordan himself. I know he wouldn't be happy. Next, Stick or Twist, an article by Jade Wilson. Ashley Insko sleeps in a prison unit with 33 men at Avery Mitchell Correctional Institution in Spruce Pine, North Carolina. Insko, a 40-year-old intersex transgender woman, is waiting to be recognized and treated in alignment with her gender identity and has been housed at Avery Mitchell since early 2018 when she transferred from another all-men's facility, Craven Correctional. Her most recent transfer requests have been repeatedly denied. Late last month, Insko's attorney filed a court order against North Carolina's Commissioner of Prisons, Todd Ishii, asking the court to force Ishii to transfer Insko to a woman's facility. In North Carolina, transgender, gender variant, and intersex people are housed by the gender assigned to them at birth, or their genital characteristics, which puts them at a higher risk of physical and sexual violence. Insko, who is expected to serve a prison sentence for robbery until 2031, told the Indy, I just want to be safe and make it home. In March, Insko sent a letter to a group of advocates seeking help with her case and explaining she has constant pain in her abdomen and needs surgery to remove residual painful gonad material. She wrote in the letter, DPS need not wait for a tragedy to respond to the dire needs of intersex and transgender persons in its care. I'm facing escalating distress and growing fears for my safety. I filed grievances within the DPS system and have exhausted those remedies with nothing in return but denials, heartache, and fear of retaliation by officials. This summer, North Carolina Department of Public Safety, DPS, Prisoner Commissioner Ishii and his counsel received an 11-page letter from Emancipate NC Interact. That's Advocates for Intersex Youth, Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project, three organizations that are now advocating for Insko. The letter details the state's violation of Insko's human rights and demands that DPS transfer immediately to the North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women in Raleigh. It also demands that her pressing medical needs immediately be addressed. They gave prison officials until August the 24th to discuss remediation. In their request, the advocates cited the 8th and 14th Amendments and argue that DPS is violating the U.S. Constitution and even its own policies. Under the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act, prison officials are obligated to protect all incarcerated individuals and assess their risk of sexual abuse and assault and take reasonable steps to keep them safe. They are also obligated to provide adequate medical care. In North Carolina, requests for transgender accommodations are sent to the Facility Transgender Accommodation Review Committee, FTARC, and the Division Transgender Accommodation Review Committee. DTARC. The committees are expected to review all aspects of the request and base decisions on whether they protect an incarcerated person's welfare. In an August letter, DPS Deputy General Counsel Jody Harrison said in response to the advocates' quote, myriad allegations, that FTARC and DTARC concluded that the DPS is providing Insko with constitutionally adequate care. Writing, we are confident the decisions that these committees have made with regard to this offender have been thoughtful, deliberative, and fully in line with DPS policies. Attorneys for Insko disagree. Elizabeth Simpson, an attorney and associate director of Emancipate NC, says, unfortunately, many prison officials are transparently hostile to the rights of transgender people and this adversely affects the judgment of the TARC teams. This seems to be what's going on with Ashley because medical professionals are unanimous that she needs surgery and is a woman who would be safer in a woman's prison. On September 30, Simpson filed a writ of mandamus, a type of court order directed to the government official, but to a government official warning them that they're breaking the law. In Wake County Superior Court, asking the court to direct Commissioner Aishi to transfer Insko to a woman's facility. The FTARC met in October of 2020 to review Insko's original requests. In a letter written after that case was reviewed, Sean Hartzog, an FTARC facilitator and psychologist, says the committee, quote, presented information that endocrinologist E. Klett, M.D., had recognized this inmate's intersex condition with the documentation of XX karyotype and recommended transfer to all-female facility. DPS current policy only accommodates transgender people and not anyone with an intersex condition. Therefore, the letter continued, the quote, the team resolves that INSCO will need to accept the rules of the facility, the decision made by administration, and the decisions set by this committee. But INSCO says cases like hers should be considered on individual bases. In a March letter to the coalition, quote, despite PREA's mandate and DPS formal implementation of it, however, my case and situation demonstrates that intersex and transgender prisoners are being subjected to blanket rules with regard to placement. INSCO is not alone in her experience. Karnataka Zaire Brown, a transgender woman, was housed in a men's facility from 2017 until she finally won the battle, with assistance from her supporters, to get transferred to a woman's facility in 2019. Zaire Brown is believed to be the first transgender person to be transferred from one gender facility to another in North Carolina. And let's see. INSCO said in her letter to the Coalition of Advocates, it is my hope that the struggle and constant battle I'm facing will not only result in my transfer to a woman's prison, but also help other trans and intersex women who are in prison in North Carolina to be housed, where they not only feel safe from physical and sexual violence, but to be free of the systemic hatred, homophobia, transphobia, and binary mentality that plagues prisons. I'm pretty sure that I'll be able to get to Sarah Edwards' article called Visible City. Melva Riegel's memories of childhood in her College Heights neighborhood come easily. It was the 1950s and 60s. Her family lived in a white bungalow built by her father in 1946. The neighborhood, which makes up 12 city blocks in southeast Durham, brimmed with NC Central University professors who emphasized the importance of education to local school children, and the ethos of a community raising a child rang clear and true. Neighborhood parents organized hiking trips, cultural events, and parades. Every Christmas, Ezra L. Totten, the North Carolina Central chemist who lived across the street from Riegel family, famously synchronized the outdoor Christmas tree lights between neighboring bungalows. When switched on, the display along Christmas Tree Lane was as perfect and precise as an equation. The College Heights of today feels relatively untouched, Riegel says, though there are fewer children and, quote, most of the elders have died. The Durham surrounding College Heights has changed, though, which is one reason why Riegel, who moved to the West Coast in 1970 but returned to her childhood home in 2008 to care for an aging parent, felt it was important to join the work of preserving its history. Riegel is one of the volunteers behind Open Durham, an expansive rabbit hole of a website dedicated to archiving the city's history. The website has changed over the years, but remained online in one form or another since 2006. Each week, Riegel says she logs several hours of work on the site. Some weeks, when she gets caught up, those hours stretch to 40. Thanks to her work, those browsing the website can look up nearly any address in College Heights, a neighborhood now in the National Register of Historic Places, and find a full report on the house, including a photo, architectural specifics, and the history of past residents. Sometimes this information is sourced from county tax records. Other times, Rigel simply knows the generations who have lived there before. She says, one thing I do know is that it's very important for you to write your own history, because when someone else is writing your history, almost always, it is not accurate. Sarah Edwards writes, when I first moved into my current home, an older rental in downtown Durham, the woman moving out left behind a framed black and white photograph of a man carrying a box of butter up a set of stairs. I asked what the picture was of. She said, oh, that's this house. She directed me to Open Durham. Sure enough, when I put my address into the search bar, it conjured that photograph alongside a patchwork story of the house and a comment describing how an early inhabitant was a passenger on the first streetcar run in the neighborhood. All of a sudden, the house, with its slanted floors and weird, creaky corners, took on the dimension of past lives. Upon clicking further into the website, the heart of Durham spilled out in the form of thousands of hyperlinked archival pages. Its design was rudimentary, clearly a labor of love, but the information infinite, like Durham's own Wikipedia. Soon, in conversations with people around town, architects looking for the history behind a house, teachers planning lessons on local history, journalists digging for background, it became clear that an invisible framework, one shaping the future of the city, depended on this website. And as it turns out, it is a website run by just a handful of volunteers. One afternoon in June, I met Nicholas Levy, the current site editor of Open Durham, on a bench overlooking Durham Central Park. It was sweltering, the kind of heat that makes you think extra hard about climate change's grip on the future, so he directed me to a shady spot. An animated redhead, Levy gives the impression of a competent, resourceful person who, if you handed them a balloon, could improvise a challenging animal shape. When we sat down on a bench, he quickly pointed out the story behind it. This is dedicated to two sisters, Levy said, pulling a map out of a tote, which itself was made out of a goat feed bag. The sisters Margaret Wilson and Lydia Wilson Parker, both descendants of a man named Peyton Smith. He explained that Smith was a black Spanish-American veteran and prolific Durham businessman. Quote, when Durham Central Park was being organized, his descendants, including the women honored by these benches, sold it to the city to be developed for this purpose. Levy, a doctoral candidate in Stanford University's history department, was himself born in Moore County, North Carolina. In 2016, he moved to Durham and became plugged into a local historical work. In 2018, while working as a board member at the nonprofit Preservation Durham, the project fell into his lap. He's been obsessing over it ever since. Open Durham originally grew out of a blog run by Gary Kuber, a local doctor turned developer who also spent time moonlighting as a preservation activist and blogger. Frustrated by what he saw as a lack of government-directed preservation efforts, Kuber started blogging on the site, then called Endangered Durham, in 2006. The stakes, as he remembers it, were different then. Durham still suffered from a reputation of blight. Houses were cheap, and he did not anticipate the speed at which Durham would develop and gentrify. Back then, he says, he just hoped to advocate for the historic properties in danger of being knocked down, saying, we were still in that phase of people not really valuing downtown. There was a question of, how do we get people to actually invest in downtown? How do we get people to move into it? For a time, the blog was a regular news source. In a 2008 indie profile of Cooper, Cleveland Holloway Neighborhood Association founding member Eleni Vlachos remarked that people wake up, have their morning coffee, and see what Gary posted. Soon, the site became a nearly encyclopedic, if somewhat chaotic, inventory of the city, with pages for nearly 2,000 places. In 2011, motivated to make the site easier to navigate and contribute to, Cooper began using new software. Endangered Durham was the renamed something more hopeful. Open Durham. Cooper says, rather than it being this kind of top-down, I'm the self-appointed expert who's going to tell you about this stuff, the best person to write about a specific house is the person who grew up there or lives there now. Open Durham is editable and updatable to reflect what people think now or what people think 10 years from now. I would hope that if someone reads something and they think, what was he smoking? They'll add their own perspective to that. That's the whole idea, really, that it has that openness. In 2016, after years of running the site, Cooper, who has since pivoted to working as a career coach, donated the site to Preservation Durham. The organization has a more formal infrastructure for doing preservation work. It's been around since 1974, has board members, a small budget, and an active event and educational series, though the work of the organization still falls to one full-time employee, Executive Director April Johnson, who says in reference to the website, as communities began to gentrify and change, we can understand the evolution of the change, why it's changed, and people's stories. People can tell their own story about why maybe they've moved out of the neighborhood or why they've been forced to move out or why they decided to move into the neighborhood. In 2018, Levy took on managing Open Durham. With it, he took on the complications of a rapidly changing Durham and changing preservation ethics, too. As historians grapple with how to tell the story of the past truthfully, when so much of it has been willfully obscured. Preservation work itself has long been marked by racial inequity. Of the 95,000 homes recognized by the National Register of Historic Places, for instance, a scant 2% reflect the experiences of Black Americans, reporting in the New Yorker recently revealed. Add to this that deteriorating Black neighborhoods are often scrubbed from public memory altogether, once by highways and urban renewal, now by condo developments, and historians face something of a race against time. Levy says, the preservation movement has had a kind of identity crisis in the last 20 years or so. There's a history that has largely been defending and arguing for the architectural value and merit of homes that were predominantly owned by wealthy white folks, and the way in which we determine that a building is important, even within the category of wealthy white folks, tends to privilege the work done by men over women. Open Durham is organized by 48 neighborhoods, more than most people might even realize exist in Durham. Upon clicking a neighborhood entry, users encounter an intro paragraph alongside individual addresses that link to a page with pictures and sometimes anecdotal comments posted by readers. For example, at 3112 Roxborough Road, quote, Johnny's Country Store had the coldest beer in town in the 1970s. For history nerds, this kind of database is obviously invaluable, but as development continues aggressively apace, tech companies bring high-income populations to the triangle, house prices rise. In 2021, the median home price in the triangle rose to $357,000, and longtime residents find their doors papered with glossy home offers. It is also the only evidence of and argument for a rapidly vanishing city. to illustrate the value of a contributor-friendly platform, Levy describes the metamorphosis of one particular site entry about a block of East Main Street. The block, which had once housed the mega mansion of the white supremacist Julian Carr, was home during the 1950s to a diner at 111 South Dillard Street, owned by a white family. For a while, the site entry featured the idyllic diner pictures that had been submitted from that era. Later, though, a woman named Rashida Brandt reached out with information about what the diner had transformed into in the 1980s, a vibrant black hair salon owned by her father, Ernest Brandt. Brandt is quoted as saying on the site, "If you ever sat in his chair, you were guaranteed to get an in-depth black history lesson and a beautiful hairstyle, all while Anita Baker or Miles Davis played in the background. This address will always hold a special place in my heart, and I am extremely proud that my father will forever be a part of the history of Durham, North Carolina." Now, the page for 111 South Dillard reflects both chapters of the building. Levy says there was a huge blind spot, not just decades in the history of the single building, but it was also sort of a microcosm, the history of white flight and black businesses, and a number of other things that have been really important but kind of under-dialogued. Part of the challenge, he says, is getting people, and therefore policies and funding, to recognize the value of the histories that look less like the Biltmore estate and more like the College Heights neighborhood of Melva Rigel's childhood. Levy says, in some ways, this is an American problem. We have difficulty reading history that doesn't look like a 12th century French cathedral or something. And by we, unfortunately, I mean the kind of dominant white supremacist interpretation of historical value. There is some good news on that front. Nationwide, the work of activists fighting to preserve black history is steadily gaining overdue recognition. Locally, structures like Pauli Murray's home in Durham have received federal recognition in the past few years, and most recently a $1.6 million Andrew Mellon grant. While Preservation Durham has done substantial work protecting and restoring black burial grounds. Still, after foundational neglect, the work of historical preservation remains an uphill battle, particularly when so much of it is shouldered by just a few people. Drupal 7, the content management system that Open Durham was built on, expires in November of 2022. Issues with the server caused the site to crash for a couple months this summer, causing readers to worry that it had disappeared forever. Levy made a call for tech help as he rebooted the site. He says, "We have no budget for it beyond paying its hosting fee." Running it, as he explains, is a taxing, full-time, unpaid job, consuming both his time and an extra room in his house, which has become crammed with local historical ephemera that people send him. Diaries of a black minister from the 1920s, newspaper clippings, tackle boxes of slide film, not knowing what else to do with it. In July, a reader of the site reached out to Levy and donated a substantial sum of money to Open Durham, requesting anonymity. During a tight moment, the donation was enough to fund migrating the site to a new platform, which Levy says he should be able to do by next year's November deadline. There are also ongoing donation links on both Preservation Durham and Open Durham's websites. Public history sites like Open Durham exist in other cities, says April Johnson, though she doesn't know of many in mid-sized southern cities like Durham. She says, "I look forward to it continuing to be a community digital public history. As we move into the future, I believe more and more people will be using the digital space to learn." And so the site for now lives on. Levy can't help but brighten, too, when he thinks of its future. He has hopes of making it more navigable with a design that encourages more users to contribute. And he says, it wouldn't be much of a website if it just came from me. That wouldn't take in the sort of breadth and perspective that makes public history resources really rich. I'd love to draw attention to the incredible collections at Duke's Special Collections and UNC Special Collections and the North Carolina Collection in the Durham County Library. Down the hill beside us, a pair of teenagers at Durham Central Park, presumably based on the PDA, a couple, were posing and taking pictures in front of a sculpture. It seemed almost too on the nose to be watching the next generation interact with public art, as Levy spoke about the previous generations that had lived on the ground we stood on. But it squared with the mission of Open Durham. The past and the future both live with us. Levy says in reference to the website, I would like for it to be a place where people recognize that history is something that they have a stake in, that they may be a part of it, and they may have something to contribute to as well. Well, two new theatrical productions are discussed in Indie Week in a column by Byron Woods, as is a new music review by Dan Ruccia of a new release by Cochon, which he says marks the end for the deranged playfulness of that trio. But I have run out of time for this week, and I have pulled on the string to start signaling the crew to haul me up to the surface. And this recording, though, is going to be available, as all of them are, at the Listen tabs of ncreadingservice.org. And there's enough oxygen left for me to say I'm John Feddersen, and I'm signing off for the Indie Week.